Imagine the federal government just knocking on your hotel's door and threatening to shut down your entire operation.
Which is every operator's worst nightmare,
Right.
right?
But, not because of a fire code violation or like a zoning issue,
Hmm.
but because the artisanal gin you're making at the lobby bar threatens their national tax revenue.
Yeah, it sounds completely absurd.
It does. But there is this massive legal battle over basically homemade moonshine right now. And it's quietly rewriting the rules of the U.S.
It
economy.
really is.
And by extension, it's changing the fundamental valuation of commercial real estate. So if you're an institutional investor or, a portfolio manager tuning in, consider this your high-level briefing.
Exactly. Because if you're managing a commercial portfolio right now and you're only looking at standard indicators like interest rates or consumer spending,
You're missing the big picture.
you are entirely missing a systemic shift in how federal regulatory power actually operates.
Right, which is exactly why we're doing this deep dive today. We need to look at how these macro-level legal rulings actually, trickle down to your balance sheet.
Yeah, it's crucial right now.
And our roadmap for this comes from one really, really fantastic source. It's the latest Pre's Perspective newsletter, authored by Priyanshu, or Priyadafakkar.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, Pri is a top-tier commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor. His newsletter is honestly a vital tool for understanding this current market.
Oh, definitely.
And what makes this specific analysis so compelling is that he makes this completely unexpected connection. I mean, he takes this niche lawsuit about hobbyist distillers and maps out exactly how it impacts the underwriting of adaptive reuse projects.
Right, and hospitality assets in general.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's get right into the catalyst here. We're looking at a case called McNutt v. DOJ.
Yeah, McNutt v. DOJ.
And to really understand it, we have to rewind to a piece of federal legislation from 1868.
Wow, going way back.
Yeah, literally post-Civil War. So this statute explicitly prohibits the use of a still, as in distilling spirits, in any dwelling, or even an enclosure connected to a dwelling.
Basically, banning homemade liquor entirely.
Exactly. So fast forward to today, and this guy, Scott McNutt, along with the Hobby Distillers Association, they decide to finally challenge this.
Right?
They're arguing that this 1868 ban fundamentally exceeds the government's constitutional powers.
And, on the surface, a ban on home distilling sounds like, well, it sounds like a fringe issue, right?
Yeah, like something for historical reenactors or something.
Exactly. But the legal foundation beneath this specific statute is, I mean, it's tectonic. The federal government has historically relied on the Commerce Clause and its taxing power to broadly regulate what citizens can and cannot produce.
Even in the privacy of their own home.
Even in their own homes, yeah.
And that foundation basically cracked wide open on April 10th, 2026.
It really did.
Because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. The court stated this principle that, honestly, it seems like common sense, but legally it's an earthquake.
Oh, totally.
They said the federal government cannot ban a primary activity, so distilling spirits, simply because they might want to tax the end result later.
That is the absolute crux of the issue right there. Because the headline you'll see on the news is just Moonshine is Legal.
Right, which completely misses the point.
It completely misses the actual story. As Pri points out in his newsletter, this is a high-stakes battle over the limits of federal jurisdiction itself.
Yeah.
The court is essentially drawing a line in the sand regarding how far the government's taxing power can reach into, non-commercial interstate activities.
And the newsletter uses this brilliant analogy that really just clarifies the overreach we're talking about here. Like, if the feds have the constitutional authority to ban you from making your own spirits solely to protect their tax revenue.
Right, where does it end?
Exactly. Where does that jurisdiction actually stop? What's stopping Washington from, say, banning you from growing tomatoes in your backyard to protect grocery taxes?
Or banning DIY home repairs, right, because that cuts into the taxable revenue of the local plumbing industry.
Exactly. It's a profound logical extension. If they can ban an entirely personal activity just because it theoretically competes with a taxable market.
Then there's virtually no limit to federal regulatory power. None.
Right. They can regulate every single aspect of private production.
Exactly. We are looking at a fundamental debate over the mechanics of how the U.S. economy is governed.
But, okay, let's pause here and play devil's advocate for a second, because we have to look at the Department of Justice's argument impartially. As analysts, we have to weigh the systemic risks on both sides for our listeners.
Of course.
The DOJ is fighting this ruling incredibly aggressively, And they aren't just doing it to be difficult. They have a really legitimate structural concern regarding federal revenue predictability.
Oh, absolutely they do. The DOJ's defense hinges on this macroeconomic concept known as the aggregation principle.
Right.
They argue that, okay, sure, one person distilling a few gallons of spirits in their basement, that doesn't impact the national economy.
It's just a drop in the bucket.
Literally. But you can't look at it in isolation. If you aggregate that personal small batch production across the entire population of the U.S.,
then it heavily affects the national interstate market for alcohol.
Exactly. It scales up fast.
Right. So they're essentially warning of this massive tax loophole. If the Fifth Circuit's ruling stands, you create what the government calls a moonshine free-for-all.
Which would severely destabilize their revenue streams.
Yeah. The DOJ insists that the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution basically means the government must have the power to prevent tax evasion before it even starts.
Right.
They're saying the only way to effectively tax commercial spirits is to just ban the untaxed homemade alternative completely.
And, I mean, from a strictly administrative standpoint, weakening that authority does pose a massive risk to how the federal government projects its budgets.
For sure.
But to really grasp why the DOJ is so terrified here, you have to look at the legal precedent they're relying on, because this entire argument rests on the shadow of a 1942 Supreme Court case.
Oh, Wickard v. Filburn.
Wickard v. Filburn.
Yes. That case is basically the gravitational center of federal regulatory power.
It is the bedrock.
Almost everything the modern administrative state does revolves around the logic established in that 1942 ruling.
Yeah, and for those who might not remember from law school, in Wickard, you had this farmer who was growing wheat solely for his own animals, on his own land.
Wait, just for his own farm?
Just his own farm. He wasn't selling it across state lines. He wasn't even selling it in his own town.
Wow.
But the Supreme Court ruled that he could still be penalized under federal quotas.
Which is crazy to think about today.
It is. And their reasoning was that because his personal production meant he wasn't buying wheat on the open market.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. By not participating in the market, he was therefore affecting interstate commerce.
Which basically just handed the federal government nearly unlimited power over local production for the last, what, 80 years?
Yep. Because if growing wheat for your own cows affects interstate commerce, then literally everything affects interstate commerce.
Right. Everything.
Yeah.
And so the massive question Prize Newsletter raises for investors to watch right now is this. Will the current Supreme Court finally use McNutt v. DOJ to chip away at that Wickard precedent?
Because if they do, the implications for the American economy are just staggering.
Okay, but let me pause you there.
Yeah.
Because if I'm a portfolio manager listening to this, I probably don't really care about a 1942 farmer's wheat.
Fair enough.
How does this constitutional tug of war actually impact the cap rate of the boutique hotel I'm trying to underwrite today? Like, why should I care?
Well, because it changes the entire regulatory climate that your asset operates within. If we connect this legal battle to the bigger picture, we are looking at the potential defederalization of local commerce.
Defederalization.
Right. Stripping Washington of its ability to broadly regulate non-commercial localized activities just under the guise of protecting national tax revenues.
Right.
And when those federal bans fall, they don't just disappear into a vacuum. They are immediately replaced by a patchwork of state-level regulations.
Wait, hold on, though. A patchwork of state laws? That sounds like an absolute compliance nightmare.
Well,
I mean, historically, isn't dealing with fragmented local zoning boards and like 50 different state legislatures the hardest part of real estate development?
It can be, yeah.
If I'm a national brand operator trying to scale a standardized hotel model across 20 states, a fragmented regulatory landscape sounds like my worst enemy. Why is this a good thing?
You're completely right. It is a massive headache if you are operating a rigid, one-size-fits-all corporate model.
Right.
But what is a nightmare for a standardized mega brand is actually an asymmetrical opportunity for agile, localized operators.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. As Pree notes in his briefing, a victory for McNutt emboldens states to set their own rules. State legislatures will suddenly have the autonomy to aggressively incentivize cottage industries.
Right, like micro-distilleries.
Exactly. Micro-distilleries, specialized hospitality ventures, all without that looming threat of federal intervention shutting them down.
I see. So if I'm underwriting a new development, the value of state-level incentives and local zoning just became the dominant variable in my financial model.
Precisely. The regulatory friction moves from Washington down to the state house.
And the risk of federal police power stepping in and overriding a hyper-local operation is basically neutralized.
Right. And remember, states are inherently more competitive with one another when it comes to attracting development and tourism.
Yeah, they want the tax base.
Exactly. So if a developer wants to innovate with a niche localized venture, they suddenly have a whole new layer of legal security.
Which brings us directly to the core concept in Preet's newsletter. The analysis takes this macro shift, so the weakening of the Wickard precedent, and applies it directly to specific CRE asset classes.
Yeah, this is where it gets really practical.
It all comes back to that golden rule of real estate, finding the highest and best use for a property.
Always.
And for those outside the daily grind of development, that essentially just means figuring out exactly what goes inside those four walls to squeeze the absolute maximum financial value out of the dirt it sits on.
And what we are forecasting based on this data is a massive surge in a very specific trend.
Micro-hospitality.
Micro-hospitality.
Let's define that for our listeners, because this is where the theoretical legal debate hits the P&L statement. The perspective Preet gives here asks us to imagine boutique hotels that are fundamentally different from traditional lodging assets.
Right. Think about the standard model for a second. A hotel sells rooms, and maybe it has a restaurant or a bar that brings in, you know, generic mass market inventory.
Yeah, standard stuff.
Micro-hospitality completely flips that script. Instead of just being a place to sleep, the asset becomes a center of hyper-local production.
Okay.
We are talking about a boutique hotel that isn't just serving local artisanal spirits, but is legally protected to actually produce them on site.
In house.
Exactly. Alongside other homegrown amenities.
Okay. Let's walk through the actual financial mechanics of that. Because the implications for a property's net operating income, the NOI, are staggering here.
They really are.
If you vertically integrate your food and beverage production, meaning, you know, you distill the spirits right there in the hotel lobby or the basement,
yeah,
and you're suddenly free from the massive burden of federal excise taxes and federal compliance overhead.
Your profit margins artificially inflate.
Right.
Dramatically.
Right. If your F&B margin jumps from, say, 20% up to 50% because you've eliminated the federal middleman, your NOI spikes.
And in commercial real estate, when your NOI goes up, the overall valuation of the asset goes up exponentially.
Because of standard capitalization rates.
Yeah, exactly. It turns a standard hospitality asset into a highly profitable, legally protected local production hub.
Which perfectly tees up the most important concept in today's briefing. Preet calls it the sovereignty of the asset.
Yeah, Preet's phrase there is perfect. The sovereignty of the asset.
What does that actually mean in practice, though, for an investor?
It means that the physical property itself holds unique intrinsic value based on what it is legally allowed to produce.
Oh, okay.
And that value is governed by local zoning rather than blanket federal mandates. When the federal government's broad police power is reined in, the value of holding favorable, specific local zoning just skyrockets.
Because it creates a regulatory moat around the property.
Exactly. A moat. If you secure the right zoning for a micro-hospitality venture in a state that embraces this defederalization, you possess an asset that cannot be easily replicated by a massive corporate brand.
Right. Hilton or Marriott can't just, you know, drop a standardized box next door and compete with the hyper-local production rights you've secured.
They literally can't. As Prince points out in this week's perspective, this cowboy spirit of independence actually has the law on its side now.
Wow.
And this dramatically improves the risk-reward profile for very specific types of investments. The prime example here is the adaptive reuse project.
Right. Taking an old, obsolete structure and repurposing it.
Yeah. Picture, like, an abandoned 19th century textile mill or an old industrial warehouse.
Sure.
Previously, underwriting the conversion of that space into a boutique hotel with an on-site distillery was a massive risk. I mean, the federal compliance alone could kill the deal.
Oh, absolutely. The red tape would be a nightmare.
But under this new framework, converting that historic building into a hyper-local, production-focused hospitality asset becomes incredibly attractive.
Because the legal risk goes down.
The legal risk goes down because federal overreach is curtailed. While the unique value proposition to the consumer, the authenticity of consuming something made entirely on-site goes way up.
It's a complete paradigm shift. You aren't just navigating a generic national tax code anymore. You are operating in a localized Main Street marketplace.
Right.
And this is exactly why paying attention to seemingly obscure legal battles like a lawsuit over moonshine, is so critical right now.
You simply cannot model these returns accurately if your underwriting still assumes a one-size-fits-all federal economy.
It really can't.
The entire basis of underwriting these boutique assets has to evolve. I mean, if you are a portfolio manager who ignores the implications of the McNutt ruling, you are actively mispricing the regulatory risk of your current holdings.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, you are entirely missing the massive upside potential of adaptive reuse in the micro-hospitality sector.
You're leaving money on the table.
Tons of it.
Yeah?
Because you're applying outdated nationalized assumptions to a market that is rapidly localizing.
It is just a phenomenal synthesis of constitutional law and commercial real estate strategy. Pri really nailed this one.
He absolutely did. Pri's boots on the ground approach is unmatched here.
So let's summarize the bottom line for the institutional investors tuning in today. We are essentially witnessing the early stages of a federalism 2.0 movement.
That's the perfect way to frame it. Federalism 2.0, the pendulum of economic power is undeniably swinging.
Right.
If the Supreme Court uses this case to formally rein in the DOJ and limit the sweeping reach of that Wickard precedent we talked about,
and the economic power shifts aggressively back toward local control, local zoning, and individual production.
Exactly.
And navigating a shifting market of that magnitude requires a completely different analytical toolkit. It requires the kind of predictive, multidisciplinary analysis that can, you know, connect a post-Civil War distilling statute to the cap rate on your next commercial acquisition.
Right. And to stay ahead of the curve, you need insights from top-tier advisors who are already mapping out this new regulatory landscape.
People like Pri.
Exactly. Because knowledge is only valuable when it is understood and applied in the correct context.
And the context is changing rapidly.
It really is. The federal umbrella is shrinking, and your investment models must adapt to focus on the granular, localized value of your assets.
Which leaves us with a critical question to consider as you review your current portfolios. We are going to adapt a thought directly from the newsletter's own sign-off for you to just mull over.
Yeah, this is a great takeaway.
Given this impending shift toward cottage industry freedom and newfound asset sovereignty, will you be shifting your investment focus toward smaller, independent hospitality assets?
Or will you continue to rely on the perceived safety of major, standardized brand conversions in a market that is increasingly valuing local autonomy?
It is, without a doubt, the defining question for the next cycle of commercial real estate and hospitality investment.
Definitely something to carefully consider before your next investment committee meeting.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us for this high-level briefing. We will continue to track these systemic shifts and bring the vital intelligence directly to you. Until next time.